We'll proceed to the second case of the morning, Sutterfield v. Milwaukee. Mr. Monroe.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is John Monroe. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Krista Sutterfield. In this case, the officers broke into Ms. Sutterfield's home. They took her into custody. They seized her home. They seized her property, and they searched her home, all without a warrant. Now,
The officers here were acting pursuant to a valid statement of emergency detention when they entered her home without a warrant. Even if we assume that the Fourth Amendment would require a warrant in a situation like this, why would the officers have understood that they couldn't rely on the statement of emergency detention by itself?
Well, the statement of emergency detention is a form that the officers themselves fill out. It has none of the trappings that the Fourth Amendment requires for a warrant. There's nothing done under affidavit or affirmation.
But what type of warrant could they have been able to obtain in this situation? They weren't arresting her on probable cause to believe that she committed some sort of a crime, were they? I mean, what's the warrant that they would have?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, what type of warrant would be available, but the Fourth Amendment doesn't just go out the window because there's not a warrant available. Either they can get a warrant or they can't.
What if they did nothing? Just, I mean, not in hindsight, but then something happened. This is one of the suicide stuff. You know, this is kind of a controversial area about what somebody's supposed to do and to intervene.
Well, in effect, they did do nothing for 9 hours. They took some action that was ineffective, so they did nothing that was effective for 9 hours. There's nothing to indicate that at that point they needed to take any action at all. They classified it as a missing persons. They went to her home and found her there, standing upright, alert, happy, healthy. She said she wasn't in need of their services.
This is the first time, right?
No, this is the second time.
Was she there the first time? Or was
the first time they went to her house, she wasn't there, and they left. They apparently didn't think there was enough of an emergency then to break into her home. Only later, when they went back, 9 hours after the call, did they then find her at home and break in after she repeatedly told them to leave her alone.
Can I be very honest with you?
Certainly.
I think that they're remarkable police officers that they went back. Here's a woman that tells her psychiatrist, I'm going home, and I think I'll just blow my brains out. You know, I think it's pretty amazing that they cared enough to go back there.
Well, the record indicates it wasn't a matter of they cared. They said that it was they were required to. It was the department policy. They were not allowed to do anything.
That's a pretty nice department policy that they were following.
Well, how long does that policy allow someone?
I don't know, because had she blown her brains out, you'd be here with another case.
Well, I doubt that, Your Honor. But the point is, the officer testified that it never expires. It persists forever. At some point, what is the basis for them continuing to go to her home and harass her in the middle of the night? Is it a day later, a week later?
Protecting someone's life is a very well-recognized exigency.
Well, there has to be an emergency situation. There has to be something that requires immediate action. This wasn't immediate action. It was 9 hours later.
Well, they thought her behavior was erratic.
Well, actually, they didn't say that. The district judge said that he thought the behavior was erratic. And the things that he characterized as erratic, none of those really are erratic behavior. He called somewhat hostile to the police. But if you listen to the recording, there's no indication of any hostility. All she said to them was, I don't want you to come in my house. Leave me alone. But even if you somehow construe that to be a hostility, if being hostile to the police is grounds for them to break into your house and search your house and take your property, then there essentially isn't a Fourth Amendment, because plenty of people are hostile to the police when the police come in the middle of the night and bang on their doors.
Is there any issue, excessive force? Something I got some impression that she was tackled and other things. I don't know really what happened, but
yes, that is an issue, Your Honor. After they broke into the house, they rushed in, tackled to the floor. She incurred some minor personal injury and some minor property damage as a result of that.
But that didn't seem to be part of the claim.
Well,
Lord got carried away with this gun issue about Second Amendment, and maybe that's an issue you have, but that seemed to be the district judge said he's not going to go there.
Right. No, there was an issue with the seizure of her person. The district judge, he said that wasn't an issue, but that's clearly in the complaint.
About the guns. I think you were arguing about the Second Amendment, right?
Yes, we did have a Second Amendment.
That may be an issue that you focus on individually. I don't know, but maybe you have expertise there. But that just seemed like such a sidetrack to me, at least. And district judge didn't want to go there, he said.
No, and frankly, I'm not sure I understand that. I don't know how you can just
Well, because
not
you
go
spend
there.
A lot of time on it, that's why.
I'm sorry?
You spend a lot of time on it in your brief and others about this Second Amendment stuff. And you know, okay, they took the guns that maybe you think is a poor excuse for taking them out of the house when she was gone. Said there was some excuse about maybe a juvenile will come along and may find these guns in this CD package. I acknowledge that's pretty far-fetched to have to take those out of there, but that
certainly is.
The whole thing is about her, I hope.
It's multiple things. It's the entering of her home, breaking into the door,
the warrant,
seizing her person,
mm-hmm.
searching the house, and seizing the property, including the gun. But there's also the issue of seizing the licenses, which neither the appellees nor the district court ever explained why the seizure of the licenses was permissible.
Could you explain why you're relying on the Second Amendment rather than the Fourth and contesting the seizure of the gun and the licenses?
I'm relying on both, Your Honor. There's a Fourth Amendment claim for the seizure without a warrant for all of the property, and then there's also on top of that a Second Amendment claim for the seizure of the gun because it was taken from her home, and this court has found under Ezell that that not quite strict scrutiny is the standard that applies when you're talking about a ban on having a gun range. And here we're talking about what the Supreme Court has stated is basically the pinnacle of the core right is to have an operable firearm within the home, and that's what was actually taken from her.
Where do you rely on the Fourth Amendment for the warrantless seizure of the firearms and licenses? I thought that was the Second Amendment.
Well, no, there's a Fourth Amendment claim for all of the search and seizure in her home, including the firearms and the licenses.
What else did they take?
So Judge Stadmiller was absolutely incorrect when he said that the opening of the case might well have constituted a violation of her Fourth Amendment rights?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
He was wrong.
No, he was correct. I believe he was correct that it did constitute a violation of her Fourth Amendment rights.
Yeah, but he thought you were invoking Second Amendment rights.
No, I think what he was saying there is that probably is a Fourth Amendment violation, but I don't have to find that because of the qualified immunity. But I think what he said was, I think the plaintiff below is correct. It's a Fourth Amendment violation, but I don't have to worry about it because they have qualified immunity. I think that's what he was saying. But we definitely brought a Fourth Amendment claim for the seizure of the property. And Your Honor answered your question. I think a firearm was taken, some ammunition, a couple of firearms licenses issued by states other than Wisconsin, and a BB gun.
These are things more than were in the CD box?
Yes, there were things.
Some beside that, they found some other guns or something?
Yeah, the BB gun, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, that was in another place?
It was in another place. I think it was sitting on top of the refrigerator or something like that. But Your Honor, if you'd like, I could perhaps point you to the complaint where we mentioned that, if that would be helpful. If you'd look at paragraph 28 of the amended complaint, by seizing plaintiff's firearm from within her own home without a warrant and without an exception to the warrant requirement, the officers violated plaintiff's right to be free from unreasonable seizures. I think that's clearly a reference to the Fourth Amendment. If there are no other questions, Your Honor, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Mr. Stevens?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Adam Stevens. I am representing the City of Milwaukee in this matter. I think this case is a good illustration of the difficult position police get put in when they're responding to mental health crises. In this particular case, two police officers were dispatched to a complaint that a psychiatrist, the plaintiff's own physician, called the police saying that she was upset to the point of going home and blowing her brains up. Furthermore, the psychiatrist told the police officers, the initial two police officers, that she believed she had the means to carry out that threat because she wore a holster on her hip. Lastly, and importantly, for this court's consideration, the doctor herself told police that she feared for her patient's safety and that she needed intervention. That was the understanding that the police had when they first went to Ms. Sutterfield's home. That call came to police around 11 o'clock in the morning, 11:30 in the morning. I believe by 2 o'clock the police officers were at the house, the plaintiff's house, and they didn't find her there. I believe the record does have some limited information in it saying that they did ask neighbors and they just determined she wasn't there, so they left. As is,
they get a call at 11 and they arrive at when? 2?
I believe they arrived at, yes, it took some time. I think they went to the...
They weren't seeking any legal process, were they?
No.
So that seems, for a large metropolitan department, kind of a delay reaction to what you label, Mr. Stevens, an emergency.
Well, that is an interesting point, because I'm trying to examine this emergency situation is different, I believe, in a psychiatric crisis moment than a typical emergency situation that case law talks about, whether it's a murder victim or a potential murder victim or somebody who's bleeding or injured. Those kinds of physical injuries that need what we often think of as immediate response and something that police officers can't emergency break down the door.
What analysis, other than a call from a licensed physician that she believes that there's an imminent potential for a suicide?
Well, according to Wisconsin Statute Section 51.15, the fact that that complaint was made was grounds for the police officers to act.
I'm not questioning that. I'm questioning the emergency nature and the attendant response. It's not a rural community with a sheriff's department of 6. This is a large metropolitan police department.
Correct. But I think factually, Your Honor, I think what happened here is the police officers went to the hospital first to look for the plaintiff at the hospital because that's where the doctor was and that's where she was last seen.
The doctor didn't inform them of the location of the potential suicide?
No, she said that she just left my office. That's why the doctor called the police initially, is because she said, the patient left my office. I don't know where she went. I believe she identified the kind of or color of the car, maybe, or maybe perhaps.
They seize this woman, and then they take these weapons, right? Well, if you've got the body of the individual, what's the need of the seizure of the weapons?
Well, I think the district court highlighted the fact that there was some problematic issues with it, but I also think that there was a legitimate concern by two of the officers that were in the record. Number one, there was some indication that there was a juvenile involved in the situation because of the threat. The reason that she was upset was because she was losing her son.
No, what's that? What do you mean? That's why I had that same focus. What was the police officer said something about concerned about leaving the guns there.
Right.
What's the deal with the son?
The sergeant who responded, who ultimately pulled the door open, in his affidavit mentioned that there was, it was his understanding, and it's in the emergency detention report, which the court has. It's sealed, but you have the actual report that they had on scene. And the basis of that minor was the fact that the plaintiff had said to her physician that She was told in a phone call moments before her meeting with the physician that she was never going to see her son again. And because she was told she was never going to see her son again, she became upset to the point of wanting to go home and blow her brains out. It is a passing reference, and that is all the evidence in the record. And the appellant is correct. There's no evidence to show that the son lived at the home where they were. But I think that's where the idea of a juvenile came from in the minds of the police. But more importantly, I think what is also in the record was the fear that the police officers had once they had taken her into protective custody in order to take her to the mental health center, that in their experience, they were concerned that if she was to be released from the mental health center, she would come home and either do what she said she was going to do by killing herself or use the BB gun, which was made to look like a Glock 29, I believe, and use it for suicide by cop, for instance.
Now, you said released from the health center. Was she confined or something?
Right. Pursuant to Chapter 51.15, which I would mention, the appellant never challenged the constitutionality of Chapter 51.15, nor did he make a Monell claim saying that the city shouldn't be abiding by Chapter 51. But what the statute says is that once there is a reasonable basis for police to believe somebody's in a mental psychiatric crisis because they've made an overt threat, a recent overt threat, which I think was found here, they have the right and the authority to seize that person, put them in protective custody, and in Milwaukee County, take them specifically to the mental health facility.
Okay, that isn't what I meant, because I got the impression that when the doctor called, that the police first went to wherever that was. So that
yes.
was not some place where she was detained.
Correct. There were two different places.
That was an office visit of some kind or
Correct.
Whatever, and they went there first, thinking that she was still proximate or something or other.
Correct.
Okay, and it was after that they went to the home. Judge Fong was talking about the time frame between, I don't know, was it 11-something phone call?
Yeah, it was between 11:05 and 11:35, according to the emergency detention report.
11:30, just one way. And then they arrived at the home at somewhere around 2?
Correct. Well, we don't. These are approximations because they came to the house. I believe they spent some time. My understanding was they were actively looking for her this entire period. It wasn't like they took a coffee break or unlike, you know, some of the case law where the FBI went and had lunch and then they came back later. I don't believe that's true. And I think they immediately took efforts to find her. They couldn't find her. They looked around the house, maybe talked to some neighbors. And at the end of the day, they couldn't find her, and that was at the end of their shift. So they filled out the paperwork, the statement on emergency detention, which I believe is important, and I would ask the court, interestingly in this case, you have kind of the bookends of information, meaning you have the officers that are defendants in those cases. The initial two officers are not defendants in this case. It's only the officers who came at 8 and 9 o'clock that night that forced their way in are the defendants. But you have the information that the defendant officers had, meaning the fact that the dog they believed, I think it's an objective, reasonable belief, that the doctor feared for the patient's safety and stated she needed an intervention. And then you also have, as the other end of the bookend of this event, you have the recording of the 911 call that the plaintiff made while they were at her door. And you will hear the voice of, that is Sergeant Birkin, who is the defendant in this case, and you will hear his voice interacting with it. So, you know, for what that's worth, I think it kind of puts this court in a unique position to have those kind of facts before it.
That was the first actual encounter with her then?
Correct.
They saw her and did some sort of an assessment of whatever.
I think what happened was Officer Hewitt was the sensitive crimes officer who was assigned this matter at shift change. And there's not a lot of information, but apparently she did some, you know, called the hospitals, did some background check, but she didn't leave the district station, her station, until about 8 o'clock at night, and then was joined by uniform officers who were also defendants in this case at the house.
Mr. Stevens, in the 4 hours that Officer Hewitt spent doing whatever review or the officer was about, is there any sort of warrant that could have been obtained?
I don't know.
Well, that's what I'm asking. I don't know. Judge Rovner asked. I thought a similar inquiry. As Judge Rovner asked, is there a warrant to be had here?
That is in a footnote in my brief. I asked that rhetorical question because I don't know the answer to that question. Hypothetically speaking, an arrest warrant would be the closest thing because they're not wanting to search the house. They're wanting her, and presumably she's at the home. Now, I disagree.
Well, yeah. Well, look, we know that there's this statement of emergency detention. Is there any other procedure that you have ever been aware of in Wisconsin that might involve a judge authorizing, you know, the seizure of a person who's a danger to herself?
In a psychiatric crisis, for example?
Mm-hmm. For example?
No, and in doing research for this case, looking nationally at, you know, McQuillan's, a lot of the case law on this kind of issue is state law, you know, state court law.
Sure.
It's not federal. And if not all, I believe all of those cases really hang their hats on the community caretaker exception to the war requirement rather than the exigent circumstance. And as the appellant has spoke about in his brief and at the district court level, that is not the law of the Seventh Circuit. But we have to deal with reality, and the reality was simply the law enforcement for what it's worth, and I know we have to look at this as an objectively reasonable officer who's experienced and what they should do, but the subjective beliefs of these particular officers, and I mentioned it in the brief, it never occurred to them to get a warrant because this is not something you would get a warrant for.
Before you sit down, I've just got to get this off my chest. Am I off the wall thinking that the plaintiff relied on the Second Amendment rather than the Fourth in contesting the seizure of the gun and the licenses?
No, I think he did frame his issue as a Fourth Amendment throughout, and then I think the Second Amendment claim was somewhat of an add-on. And I didn't spend a lot of time in responding to it because I didn't think that there was much legal support for that kind of position, that this is a Second Amendment case at all.
Is there any temporal limit that we should reflect upon, Mr. Stevens, in this case? Suppose everything, and I share Judge Rovner's view about you're going to be sympathetic to law enforcement officers in this situation as you advance. But if, you know, and we've got to think of the case beyond this case, obviously, we should. If we don't find this individual for several days and Dr. Bentel, I guess that's the pronunciation, only says, I don't have another scheduled appointment, are we faced with the responsible officer having to check periodically and 2 weeks later make this entry if that's the earliest they find somebody? I mean, what's our end point here?
I think clearly within, and I would feel comfortable in advancing with it if there's an active search throughout a day. I mean, clearly if we sat around for a week, there would be a problem. But I guess that kind of gets back to the original point that I was making, that psychiatric crises are different by their nature than physical crises where you're bleeding or some other kind of condition or a missing child or something like that. When you're dealing, for instance, with somebody who's in a psychiatric crisis and they tell you, I'm okay, well, that could be true, but that could also be somebody who's in psychiatric crisis who doesn't want you here because they're going to go shoot themselves.
Well, but so when do we stop being concerned if we're responsible officers for this individual?
I think you got to look at it on a case-by-case basis,
well,
and I would say
they didn't find her at home that night because she went to stay with a friend for 2 days. I'm just trying to think how if your position is to hold, what's the responsible way to frame this psychiatric crisis? I don't know if one remains suicidal for generally a series of period of time, a series of days. I just don't know. I mean, just wondering what kind of license we want to give to the seizure of an individual post the initial warning to the officers.
I I don't have a good answer for you, Your Honor. I think that it is within...
I'm critical of you for not having a good answer.
It's a difficult question, and because every psychiatric crisis, frankly, is different, you know, and there's some that are more imminent than others, I would suppose.
I have one question, just focusing, again, on contact. Was the doctor called somebody and basically said, called it off, didn't she?
Thank you. Yes. While the initial officers were, I believe, en route or at the plaintiff's house, the doctor called those officers and said, the plaintiff just called me. He says that everything's okay. I'm fine. Call off the police. Okay. And the officers documented that conversation with the doctor in their emergency detention report. Well, what is important in that statement was at no time did the doctor say, she is fine. She does not need intervention, or I don't fear for her safety anymore. I mean, frankly, if the doctor would have said, hey, I've spoken to her, everything's fine, I don't think she needs intervention anymore, I'm her clinical psychiatrist or psychoanalyst, she doesn't need it, you guys anymore, I think the police could say, okay, but absent that kind of a direction, who are the police to say, oh, you know, problem solved now because the person says she's fine? I think
Was there any other contact, either did the officers try to call her home or something? Was there any telephone contact from the department with her before they showed up at 9 or 8:30?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I don't believe so. I don't believe that the second group of officers ever had contact with Dr. Bentley.
Okay, so they just...
They were acting strictly on the basis of the
whoever went to
statement.
The door, I don't remember which order. Was it a woman?
Maybe. I'm sorry?
And the officer that went to the door...
Correct, that was Jamie Hewitt.
But she didn't have any contact by telephone before she showed up there? That's all I'm asking.
Right, I don't believe so.
I mean, I don't even know if they knew her number or whether she was going to answer. That was my question.
One thing I... Oh, all right.
No,
you
may finish the thought.
I just wanted to mention one thing because it did come up in the reply brief, and it had to do with the seizure of the gun inside the CD case. And that issue, I think, is the reason in this concept that we didn't, you know, we're not defending the fact that they unconstitutionally seized the licenses. The reason the licenses were seized was because it was in the same CD case as the firearm. And frankly, as Judge Fine said in his concurring opinion in the unpublished decision that I attached to my brief, it was a unpublished Wisconsin case that talked about this kind of an issue that the district court relied on in its decision, and that's why I included it. But Judge Fine, much like our officer, said, look, if you can find evidence of weapons at somebody's house who's in psychiatric crisis and you're going to take them to the mental health hospital, it might be a good idea to take some evidence to support the contention that, A, the firearms are available, and, B, there's a problem. And I would argue the fact that there was a smiley face sticker over the barrel of the gun and multiple licenses from different states inside of that, I don't say it proves anything, but an officer reasonably could say there's something odd about that situation, I will seize this and let the professionals, the mental health professionals, figure this out.
Well, somebody said that. Did the doctor say she's wearing a holster?
Yes.
I mean, that's a pretty unusual garment. So I assume if somebody's wearing a holster, and frankly, is there a concealed law or Wisconsin? Or
not at this time. There now is a concealed carry law, but at the time of this event, there was not a right to conceal.
Well, I mean, it wasn't just a gimmick. She's wearing a holster, so that gives some indication maybe she's interested in carrying guns around. I don't know.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to discuss the issue of the warrant or what kind of warrant could have been obtained. The bottom line is the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution generally limit the outer limits of state action. It's up to the states to decide what kind of procedures they want to implement within the confines of the Constitution. If Wisconsin has not implemented some kind of process or procedure for issuing some kind of warrant for this kind of situation, that doesn't mean you get to throw the Fourth Amendment out the window. The Fourth Amendment still is there. It still absolutely prohibits entrance into the home and seizures without a warrant unless there is an exception. And the only exception that's really been discussed today is the exigent circumstances, emergency kind of thing. And this court has ruled that waiting 30 minutes is too long. If you have 30 minutes, you have time to get a warrant. In this case, the wait was 9 hours.
Well, are you suggesting there is a warrant to be had here, Ms. Miller?
I don't know. I don't know that there is, and I don't know that there isn't. But my point is, if Wisconsin doesn't have such a warrant, that doesn't mean that the officers just get to ignore the Fourth Amendment. Either there's a warrant they can get and they should get it, or if there's not, then there's really nothing they can do.
In circumstances, would you suggest that none existed here in light of the physician's initial call?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part.
In light of the physician's initial call, would you suggest that there were not exigent circumstances?
I think it's possible there were exigent circumstances at the time of the call. I mean, if the officers would have gone there and, for example, Ms. Sutterfield would have still been there and the doctor said, I really think she needs to go to the mental hospital,
They couldn't find her.
But that's my point. At some point, the emergency ends. It can't be an emergency forever.
How about the confines of a day?
Well,
everything operates here within a day.
Well, this court's ruled that 30 minutes is too long. 9 hours, I don't know. They went to her house earlier, by the way, 7 hours earlier, and they knocked on the door and nothing happened. Now, if they thought an emergency existed, why didn't they knock the door down then and go in and make sure she was okay? They just knocked on the door and left, and nobody went back for 7 hours. And there's nothing in the record to indicate they were really doing anything during that time.
But nobody sued those two.
Pardon?
Nobody sued those two police officers.
Nobody did. That's correct. But all they did was go knock on the door.
Well, should you have sued them?
What for?
For going away.
I don't see the tort there. But
so, in other words, what I'm trying to get to is, in a perfect world, what you would see is that would have been the end of it. They came, they knocked, no one answers. That's it. Bye-bye. So long.
Well, actually, I don't have any objection to them going back to her house at 9 o'clock that night and knocking on the door. But the part that's objected to is that they broke the door down and seized her and searched her house and seized her property.
Well, that's important because I think that, logically, that's ultimately when they had their first encounter. There was not any telephone contact with her before, was there?
She had telephone contact with Dr. Bentel, but I don't know that she had it with the police.
No, not with the police. I mean, I don't know, maybe it's logical that you call the phone if they had her phone number, I don't know. But
And Dr. Bentel did give them her phone number.
Okay, well, there's no evidence one way or the other whether or not they called, and she answered the phone and didn't want to talk to him or something like that. So that didn't happen, otherwise we'd know about it, I assume. So this is the first encounter, and then the first officer there wants to wait for somebody with more authority, I guess, to barge in, and of course that's what happened. And to say there's 30 minutes to get a warrant, of course we can't define what kind of a warrant it would be, and that's the problem. We've got this statement of emergency detention, which is sort of a quasi warrant. It's whatever it is, it's an alert, and now somebody's got to do something, and we don't know the answer to that, I guess.
Well, certainly the state of Wisconsin does issue capias warrants. Presumably they could have issued one, but I don't know. They didn't try to get one at all. They didn't attempt. They said they didn't think one was necessary.
A habeas warrant, is that what you call it?
A capias.
Capias. I'm sorry, what?
Capias.
I don't know what that is.
It's a warrant that's issued when, I think, it's equivalent to like a bench warrant or something like that.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the